In my 12 years as a Muslim minister, I had always taught so strongly on the moral issues that many Muslims accused me of being anti-woman. The very keel of my teaching and my most bone-deep personal belief was that Elijah Muhammad, in every aspect of his existence, was a symbol of moral, mental, and spiritual reform among the American black people. For 12 years, I had taught that within the entire nation of Islam, my own transformation was the best example I knew of Mr. until I married, about 12 years later, because of Mr. Muhammad's influence upon me, I had never touched a woman. But around now, if anyone had noticed, spoke less and less. I taught social doctrine to Muslims and current events, politics. I stayed wholly off the subject of morality. And the reason for this was that my faith had been shaken in a way that I can never fully describe. For I had discovered Muslims had been betrayed by Elijah Muhammad himself. I want to make this as brief as I can. Only enough so that my position and my reactions will be understood. As to whether or not I should reveal this, there's no longer any need for any question in my mind for now. The public knows. To make it concise, I will quote from one wire service story as it appeared in newspapers and was reported over radio and television across the United States. Los Angeles, July 3rd, UPI. Elijah Muhammad, 67-year-old leader of the black Muslim movement, today faced paternity suit two former secretaries who charged he fathered their four children. Both women are in their 20s. Miss Rosary and Miss Williams charged they had intimacies with Elijah Muhammad from 1957 until this year. Miss Rosary alleged he fathered her two children and said she was expecting a third child by him. The other plaintiff said he was the father of her daughter. As far back as 1955, I had heard hints, but believe me when I tell you this. For me even to consider believing anything as insane sounding as any slightest implication of any immoral behavior of Mr. Muhammad, why, the very idea made me shake with fear. And so my mind simply refused to accept anything so grotesque as adultery mentioned in the same breath with Mr. Muhammad's name. Adultery. Why, any Muslim guilty of adultery was summarily ousted in disgrace. One of the nation's most closely kept scandals was that a succession of the personal secretaries of Mr. Muhammad had become pregnant. They were brought before Muslim courts and charged with adultery, and they confessed. Humiliated before the general body, they received sentences from 1 to 5 years of isolation. That meant they were to have no contact whatsoever with any other Muslims. No one in the world could have convinced me that Mr. Muhammad would betray the reverence bestowed upon him by all of those mosques full of poor, trusting Muslims nickeling and diming up to faithfully support the Nation of Islam, when many of those faithful were scarcely able to pay their own rents. But by late 1962, I learned reliably that numerous Muslims were leaving Mosque in Chicago. The ugly rumor was spreading swiftly, even among non-Muslim Negroes. When I thought of how the press constantly sought ways to discredit the Nation of Islam, I trembled to think of such a thing reaching the ears of some newspaper reporter, either black or white. This problem, except Mr. Muhammad himself. Ultimately, that had to be the case. But first, I went to Chicago to see Mr. Muhammad's second youngest son, Wallace Muhammad. I felt that Wallace was Mr. Muhammad's most strongly spiritual son, the son with the most objective outlook. Always, Wallace and I had shared an exceptional closeness and trust. And Wallace knew when he saw me why I had come to see him. "I know," he said. I said, I thought we should rally to help his father. Wallace said he didn't feel that his father would welcome any efforts to help him. I told myself that Wallace must be crazy. Next, I broke the rule that no Muslim is supposed to have any contact with another Muslim in the isolated state. I looked up and talked with three of the former secretaries to Mr. Muhammad. From their own mouths, I heard the stories of who had fathered their children. And from their own mouths, I heard that Elijah Muhammad had told them I was the best, greatest minister he ever had, but that someday I would leave him, turn against him. So I was dangerous. I learned from these former secretaries of Mr. Muhammad that while he was praising me to my face, he was tearing me apart behind my back. That deeply hurt me. Every day I was meeting the microphones, cameras, press reporters, and other commitments, including the Muslims of my own Mosque 7. I felt almost out of my mind. Finally, the thing crystallized for me. As long as I did nothing, I felt it was the same as being disloyal. I felt that as long as I sat down, I was not helping Mr. Muhammad when somebody needed to be standing up. So one night I wrote to Mr. Muhammad about the poison being spread about him. He telephoned me in New York. He said that when he saw me, he would discuss it. I desperately wanted to find some way, some kind of bridge, over which I was certain the Nation of Islam could be saved from self-destruction. I had faith in the nation. We weren't some group of Christian Negroes jumping and shouting and full of sins. I thought of one bridge that could be used if and when the shattering disclosure should become public. Loyal Muslims could be taught that a man's accomplishments in his life outweigh his personal human weaknesses. Wallace Muhammad helped me to review the Quran and the Bible for documentation. David's adultery with Bathsheba weighed less on history scales, for instance, than the positive fact of David's killing Goliath. Thinking of Lot, we think not of incest, but of his saving the people from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Or, our image of Noah isn't of his getting drunk, but of his building the ark and teaching people to save themselves from the flood. We think of Moses leading the Hebrews from bondage, not of Moses' adultery with the Ethiopian women. In all of the cases I reviewed, the positive outweighed the negative. Elijah Muhammad had me fly to Phoenix to see him in April 1963. We embraced as always, and almost immediately he took me outside where we began to walk by his swimming pool. He was the messenger of Allah. When I was a foul, vicious convict, so evil that other convicts had called me Satan, this man had rescued me. He was the man who had trained me, who had treated me as if I were his own flesh and blood. He was the man who had given me wings to go places, to do things I otherwise never would have dreamed of. We walked, with me caught up in a whirlwind of emotions. "Well, son," Mr. Muhammad said, "what is on your mind?" Plainly, frankly, pulling no punches, I told Mr. Muhammad what was being said. And without waiting for any response from him, I said that with his son Wallace's help, I had found in the Quran and the Bible that which might be taught to Muslims, if it became necessary, as the fulfillment of prophecy. "Son, I'm not surprised," Elijah Muhammad said. "You always have had such a good understanding of prophecy and of spiritual things. You recognize that's what all of this is, prophecy. You have the kind of understanding that only an old man has." "I'm David," he said. "When you read about how David took another man's wife, I'm that David. You read about Noah who got drunk, that's me. You read about Lot who went and laid up with his own daughters. I have to fulfill all of those things."
Hoping to ease the blow of their leader's indiscretions, Malcolm X took it upon himself to tell a select group of East Coast Muslim officials what had happened. Several of them, he discovered, already knew. Then, his attempt to put out the fire exploded in his face. In Chicago, temple officials accused Malcolm X of demeaning the character of Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm was shocked by their reaction, but it was only the first of a succession of revelations. On November 22, 1963, John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. Elijah Muhammad immediately issued a directive to his ministers to make no comment concerning the assassination. At a speaking engagement a few days later, Malcolm X was asked his opinion of Kennedy's death. He said what he felt, that it was a case of the chickens coming home to roost. The white man's hate, he said, had spread beyond the killing of innocent blacks and now had reached America's president. The climate of hate and violence in America was cited by many world leaders and journalists as a reason for Kennedy's murder. But when Malcolm X said it, the nation's newspapers screamed in outrage. And to Malcolm, it revealed another hard truth. The jealousies that Elijah Muhammad had prophesied were manifest in Elijah Muhammad himself. The Muslim leader seized on Malcolm's Kennedy comment as a reason to first silence and then banish his principal minister. But Malcolm soon learned his ouster was not enough. The Muslims wanted his life.
The first direct order for my death was issued through a Mosque 7 official who previously had been a close assistant. Another previously close assistant of mine was assigned to do the job. He was a brother with a knowledge of demolition. He was asked to wire my car to explode when I turned the ignition key. But this brother, it happened, had seen too much of my loyalty to the nation to carry out his order. Instead, he came to me. I thanked him for my life. I told him what was really going on in Chicago. He was stunned almost beyond belief. This brother was close to others in the Mosque 7 circle who might subsequently be called upon to eliminate me. He said he would take it upon himself to enlighten each of them enough so that they wouldn't allow themselves to be used. This first direct death order was how, finally, I began to arrive at my psychological divorce from the Nation of Islam. I began to see wherever I went, on the streets, in business places, on elevators, sidewalks, and passing cars, the faces of Muslims whom I knew, and I knew that any of them might be waiting the opportunity to try to put a bullet into me. I was racking my brain. What was I gonna do? My life was inseparably committed to the American black man's struggle. I was generally regarded as a leader. For years I had attacked so many so-called black leaders for their shortcomings. Now, I had to honestly ask myself what I could offer, how I was genuinely qualified to help the black people win their struggle for human rights. I had enough experience to know that in order to be a good organizer of anything which you expect to succeed, including yourself, you must almost mathematically analyze cold facts. I had, as one asset I knew, an international image. No amount of money could have bought that. I knew that if I said something newsworthy, people would read or hear of it, maybe even around the world, depending on what it was. More immediately in New York City, where I would naturally base any operation, I had a large, direct, personal following of non-Muslims. I knew that the great lack of most of the big-named Negro leaders was their lack of any true rapport with the ghetto Negroes. How could they have rapport when they spent most of their time integrating with white people? I knew that the ghetto people knew that I never left the ghetto in spirit, and I never left it physically any more than I had to. I had a ghetto instinct. For instance, I could feel if tension was beyond normal in a ghetto audience, and I could speak and understand the ghetto's language. There was an example of this that always flew into my mind every time I heard some of the big-name Negro leaders declaring they spoke for the ghetto black people. After a Harlem street rally, one of these downtown leaders and I were talking when we were approached by a Harlem hustler. To my knowledge, I'd never seen this hustler before. He said to me approximately, "Hey, baby, I dig you holding this all-original scene at the track. I'm gonna lay a vine under the Jew's balls for a dime. Got to give you a play. Got the shorts out here trying to scuffle up on some bread. Well, my man, I'll get on. Got to go peck a little and cop me some Z's." And the hustler went on up 7th Avenue. I never would have given it another thought except that this downtown leader was standing, staring after that hustler, looking as if he'd just heard Sanskrit. He asked me what had been said, and I told him. The hustler had said he was aware that the Muslims were holding an all-black bazaar at Rockland Palace, which is primarily a dance hall. The hustler intended to pawn a suit for $10 to attend and patronize the bazaar. He had very little money, but he was trying hard to make some. He was going to eat, then he would get some CBS or NBC microphones at Harvard or at Tuskegee. I could talk with the so-called middle-class Negro and with the ghetto blacks, whom all the other leaders just talked about. And because I had been a hustler, I knew better than all whites knew, and nearly all the black leaders knew, that actually the most dangerous black man in America was the ghetto hustler. Why do I say this? The hustler out there in the ghetto jungles has less respect for the white power structure than any other Negro in North America. The ghetto hustler is internally restrained by nothing. He has no religion, no concept of morality, no civic responsibility, no fear, nothing. To survive, he is out there constantly preying upon others, probing for any human weaknesses like a ferret. The ghetto hustler is forever frustrated, restless, and anxious for some action. Whatever he undertakes, he commits himself to it fully, absolutely. What makes the ghetto hustler yet more dangerous is his glamour image to the school dropout youth in the ghetto. These ghetto teenagers see the hell caught by their parents struggling to get somewhere, or see that they have given up struggling in the prejudiced, intolerant white man's world. The ghetto teenagers make up their own minds that they would rather be like the hustler, who they see dressed sharp and flashing money and displaying no respect for anybody or anything. So the ghetto youth become attracted to the hustler worlds of dope, thievery, prostitution, and general crime and immorality. It scared me the first time I really saw the danger of these ghetto teenagers ever sparked into violence. One sweltering summer afternoon, I attended a Harlem Street rally which contained a lot of these teenagers in the crowd. I had been invited by some responsible Negro leaders who normally never spoke to me. I knew they had just used my name to help them draw a crowd. The more I thought about it on the way there, the hotter I got. And when I got on the stand, I just told the crowd in the street that I wasn't really that my name had been used, and I walked off the stand. Well, what did I want to do that for? While those young teenage Negroes got upset and started milling around and yelling, upsetting the old and out, the first thing you know, traffic was blocked in four directions by a crowd whose mood quickly grew so that I really got apprehensive. I got on top of a car and began waving my arm, yelling at them to quiet down. They did quiet. And then I asked them to disperse. And they did. This was when it began being said that I was America's only Negro who could stop a race riot cold or start one. I don't know if I could do either one, but I know one thing. It had taught me in a very few minutes to have a whole lot of respect for the human combustion that is packed among the hustlers and the young admirers who live in the ghettos where the northern white man has sealed off the Negro away from white for 100 years. I reasoned that the decision already had been made for me. I felt a challenge to plan and build an organization that could help to cure the black man in North America of the sickness which has kept him under the white man's heel. Substantially, as I saw it, the organization I hoped to build was Islam in that it would embrace all faiths of black men and would carry into practice what the Nation of Islam had only preached. Rumors were swirling, particularly in East Coast cities. What was I going to do? Well, the first thing I was going to have to do was to attract far more willing hands and heads than my own. Each day, more militant action brothers who had been with me in Mosque 7 announced their break from the Nation of Islam to come with me. And each day I learned in one or another way of more support from non-Muslim Negroes, including a surprising lot of the middle and upper class black bourgeoisie who were sick of the status symbol charade. There was a growing clamor. When are you going to call a meeting to get organized? To hold the first meeting, I arranged to rent the Carver Ballroom at the Hotel Teresa, which is at the corner of 125th Street and 7th Avenue, which might be called one of Harlem's fuse box locations. The Amsterdam News reported the planned meeting, and many readers inferred that we were establishing our beginning mosque in the Teresa. Telegrams and letters and telephone calls came to the hotel for me from across the country. The general tone was that this was a move that people had waited for. People I'd never heard of expressed confidence in me in moving ways. Numerous people said that the Nation of Islam's stringent moral restrictions had repelled them, and they wanted to join me. Astonishing numbers of white people called and wrote offering contributions or asking, could they join? The answer was no, they couldn't join. Our membership was all black, but if their consciences dictated, they could financially help our constructive approach to America's race problem. Speaking engagement requests came in, 22 of them in one particular Monday morning's mail. It was startling to me that an unusual number of the requests came from groups of white Christian ministers. I called a press conference. The microphone stuck up before me. The flash bulbs popped. The reporters, men and women, white and black, representing media that reached around the world, sat looking at me with their pencils and open notebooks. I made the announcement. I am going to organize and head a new mosque in New York City known as the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. This will give us a religious base and a spiritual force necessary to rid our people of the vices that destroy the moral fiber of our community. Muslim Mosque Incorporated will have its temporary headquarters in the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. It will be the working base for an action program designed to eliminate the political oppression, the economic exploitation, and the social degradation suffered daily by 22 million Afro-Americans. Then the reporters began firing questions at me. It was not all as simple as it may sound. I went few places without constant awareness that any number of my former brothers felt they would make heroes of themselves in the Nation of Islam if they killed me. I knew how Elijah Muhammad's followers thought. I had taught so many of them to think. I knew that no one would kill you quicker than a Muslim if he felt that's what Allah wanted him to do. There was one further major preparation that I knew I needed. I'd had it in mind for a long time, as a servant of Allah, but it would require money that I didn't have. I took a plane to Boston. I was turning again to my sister Ella. Though at times I'd made Ella angry at me beneath it all, since I had first come to her as a teenaged hick from Michigan, Ella had never once really wavered from my corner. "Ella," I said, "I want to make the pilgrimage to Mecca." Ella said, "How much do you need?"
Malcolm X's life was characterized by sudden, dramatic change. From small-town boy to big-city hustler, from convict to worldwide prominence as a leader of and spokesman for his people, his pilgrimage to Mecca would inspire one more seminal change. For the first time in his life, everyone he met, from statesmen to shepherds, treated him as an equal, as a fellow human being, without regard for the color of his skin. All along his journey, he met people, black, brown, white, red, and yellow people, who helped him realize his dream. In New York, Dr. Mahmoud Youssef Chouabi, a professor at the University of Cairo and a United Nations advisor, gave him a signed letter approving his pilgrimage as required by the Saudi Arabian consulate. Dr. Chouabi also gave Malcolm a book, The Eternal Message of Muhammad. He told Malcolm that the book's author, Abdul al-Rahman Assam, was a close advisor of the Arabian ruler, Prince Faisal. Assam, he said, had followed the stories of Malcolm X in the press closely. It was the first of many signs, Malcolm felt, that Allah was with him. His experience in Mecca awakened in Malcolm a feeling he had never known, a sense of idealism, of hope that perhaps, after all, people could live together as brothers. While still in Mecca, he summed up his experience and his feelings in a letter.
I have reflected since that the letter I finally sat down to compose had been subconsciously shaping itself in my mind. The color blindness of the Muslim world's religious society and the color blindness of the Muslim world's human society, these two influences had each day been making a greater impact and an increasing persuasion against my previous way of thinking. The first letter was, of course, to my wife, Betty. I never had a moment's question that Betty, after initial amazement, would change her thinking to join mine. I had known 1,000 reassurances that Betty's faith in me was total. I knew that she would see what I had seen, that in the land of Muhammad and the land of Abraham, I had been blessed by Allah with new insight into the true religion of Islam and a better understanding of America's entire racial dilemma. After the letter to my wife, I wrote next essentially the same letter to my sister Ella, and I knew where Ella would stand. She had been saving to make the pilgrimage to Mecca herself. I wrote to Dr. Chouabi, whose belief in my sincerity had enabled me to get a passport to Mecca. All through the night, I copied similar long letters for others who were very close to me. Among them was Elijah Muhammad's son, Wallace Muhammad, who had expressed to me his conviction that the only possible salvation for the Nation of Islam would be its accepting and projecting a better understanding of Orthodox Islam. And I wrote to my loyal assistants at my newly formed Muslim Mosque Incorporated in Harlem, with a note appended, asking that my letter be duplicated and distributed to the press. I knew that when my letter became public knowledge back in America, many would be astounded, loved ones, friends, and enemies alike. and no less a standard would be millions whom I did not know, who had gained, during my 12 years with Elijah Muhammad, a hate image of Malcolm X. Even I was myself astounded. But there was a precedent in my life for this letter. My whole life has been a chronology of changes. Here is what I wrote from my heart. Never have I witnessed such sincere hospitality and the overwhelming spirit of true brotherhood as is practiced by people of all colors and races here in this ancient holy land, the home of Abraham, Muhammad, and all the other prophets and of the Holy Scriptures. For the past week I have been utterly speechless and spellbound by the graciousness I see displayed all around me by people of all colors. I have been blessed to visit the holy city of Mecca. I have made my 7 circuits around the Kaaba, led by a young mutawaf named Muhammad. I drank water from the well of Zemzem. I ran 7 times back and forth between the hills of Mount Asafa and Al-Marwa. I have prayed in the ancient city of Mina, and I have prayed on Mount Arafat. There were tens of thousands of pilgrims from all over the world. They were of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans. But we were all participating in the same ritual, displaying a spirit of unity and brotherhood that my experiences in America had led me to believe never could exist between the white and the non-white. America needs to understand Islam, because this is the one religion that erases from its society the race problem. Throughout my travels in the Muslim world, I have met, talked to, and even eaten with people who in America would have been considered white, but the white attitude was removed from their minds by the religion of Islam. I have never before seen sincere and true brotherhood practiced by all colors together, irrespective of their color. You may be shocked by these words coming from me, but on this pilgrimage, what I have seen and experienced has forced me to rearrange much of my thought patterns previously held and to toss aside some of my previous conclusions. During the past 11 days here in the Muslim world, I have eaten from the same plate, drunk from the same glass, and slept in the same bed or on the same rug while praying to the same God with fellow Muslims whose eyes were the bluest of blue, whose hair was the blondest of blonde, and whose skin was the whitest of white. And in the words and in the actions and in the deeds of the white Muslims, I felt the same sincerity that I felt among the black African Muslims of Nigeria, Sudan, and Ghana. We were truly all the same, brothers, because their belief in one God had removed the white from their minds, the white from their behavior, and the white from their attitude. I could see from this that perhaps if white Americans could accept the oneness of God, then perhaps, too, they could accept in reality the oneness of man and cease to measure and hinder and harm others in terms of their differences in color. Each hour here in the Holy Land enabled greater spiritual insights into what is happening in America with black and white. The American Negro can never be blamed for his racial animosities. He's only reacting to 400 years of the conscious racism of American whites. But as racism leads America up this path, I do believe from the experiences that I have had with them that the whites of the younger generation in the colleges and universities will see the handwriting on the wall, and many of them will turn to the spiritual path of truth, the only way left to America to ward off the disaster that racism inevitably must lead to. Never have I been so highly honored. Never have I been made to feel more humble and unworthy. Who would believe the blessings that have been heaped upon an American Negro? A few nights ago, a man who would be called in America a white man, a United Nations diplomat, an ambassador, a companion of kings, gave me his hotel suite, his bed. By this man, His Excellency Prince Faisal, who rules this holy land, was made aware of my presence here in Jeddah. The very next morning, Prince Faisal's son, in person, informed me that by the will and decree of his esteemed father, I was to be a state guest. The deputy chief of protocol himself took me before the Hajj court. His Holiness Sheikh Muhammad Harkoun himself okayed my visit to Mecca. His Holiness gave me two books on Islam with his personal seal and autograph, and he told me that he prayed that I would be a successful preacher of Islam in America. A car, a driver, and a guide have been placed at my disposal, making it possible for me to travel about this holy land almost at will. The government provides air-conditioned quarters and servants in each city that I visit. Never would I have even thought of dreaming that I would ever be a recipient of such honors. Honors that in America would be bestowed upon a king, not a Negro. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. Sincerely, El Haj Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm X.
When his pilgrimage was over, Malcolm X did not go directly home. He went instead to Lebanon, and from there back to Egypt, and then to Nigeria and Ghana. At all of these stops, he was treated as a visiting dignitary. He addressed students at leading universities and met with heads of state. And he was again struck by what was missing from these African cultures, the racial hatred that permeated the United States. He celebrated his 39th birthday in Algiers, waiting for his flight back to America. It would be his final birthday.
The Pan American jet which took me home, it was flight 115, landed at New York's Kennedy Air Terminal on May 21st at 4:25 in the afternoon. We passengers filed off the plane and toward customs. When I saw the crowd of 50 or 60 reporters and photographers, I honestly wondered what celebrity I had been on the plane with. But I was the villain they had come to meet. In Harlem especially, and also in some other U.S. cities, the 1964 long, hot summer's predicted explosions had begun. Article after article in the white man's press had cast me as a symbol, if not a causative agent, of the revolt and of the violence of the American black man wherever it had sprung up. In the biggest press conference that I had ever experienced anywhere, the camera bulbs flashed and the reporters fired questions. Mr. Malcolm X, what about those Blood brothers reportedly affiliated with your organization, reportedly trained for violence, who have killed innocent white people? Mr. Malcolm X, what about your comment that Negroes should form rifle clubs? I answered the questions. I knew I was back in America again, hearing the subjective, scapegoat-seeking questions of the white man. New York white youth were killing victims. That was a sociological problem. But when black youth killed somebody, the power structure was looking to hang somebody. When black men had been lynched or otherwise murdered in cold blood, it was always said, things will get better. When whites had rifles in their homes, the Constitution gave them the right to protect their home and themselves. But when black people even spoke of having rifles in their homes, that was ominous. I slipped in on the reporters something they hadn't been expecting. I said that the American black man needed to quit thinking what the white man had taught him, which was that the black man had no alternative except to beg for his so-called civil rights. I said that the American black man needed to recognize that he had a strong, airtight case to take to the United States before the United Nations on a formal accusation of denial of human rights, and that if Angola and South Africa were precedent cases, then there would be no easy way that the United States could escape being censured right on its own home ground. Just as I had known, the press wanted to get me off that subject. I was asked about my letter from Mecca. I was all set with a speech regarding that. I hope that once and for all my Hajj to the holy city of Mecca has established our Muslim mosque's authentic religious affiliation with the 750 million Muslims of the Orthodox Islamic world. And I know once and for all that the black Africans look upon America's 22 million blacks as long-lost brothers. They love us. They study our struggle for freedom. They were so happy to hear how we are awakening from our long sleep after so-called Christian white America had taught us to be ashamed of our African brothers and homeland. Yes, I wrote a letter from Mecca. You're asking me, didn't you say that now you accept white men as brothers? Well, my answer is that in the Muslim world I saw, I felt, and I wrote home how my thinking was broadened. Just as I wrote, I shared true brotherly love with many white-complexioned Muslims who never gave a single thought to the race or to the complexion of another Muslim. It was in the holy world that my attitude was changed, by what I experienced there, by what I witnessed there in terms of brotherhood, not just brotherhood toward me, but brotherhood between all men of all nationalities and complexions who were there. And now that I am back in America, my attitude here concerning white people has to be governed by what my black brothers and I experience here, and what we witness here in terms of brotherhood. The problem here in America is that we meet such a small minority of individual so-called good or brotherly white people. Here in the States, notwithstanding those few good white people, it is the collective 150 million white people whom the 22 million black people have to deal with. While here in America, the seeds of racism are so deeply rooted in the white people collectively, their belief that they are superior in some way is so deeply rooted that these things are in the national white subconsciousness. Many whites are even actually unaware of their own racism until they face some test, and then their racism emerges in one form or another. Listen, the white man's racism toward the black man here in America is what has got him in such trouble all over this world with other non-white peoples. The white man can't separate himself from the stigma that he automatically feels about anyone, no matter who is not his color. And the non-white peoples of the world are sick of the condescending white man. That's why you've got all this trouble in places like Vietnam or right here in the Western Hemisphere. Probably 100 million people of African descent are divided against each other, taught by their white man to hate and to mistrust each other. In the West Indies, Cuba, Brazil, Venezuela, all of South America, Central America, all of those lands are full of people with African blood. On the African continent even, the white man has maneuvered to divide the black African from the brown Arab, to divide the so-called Christian African from the Muslim African. Can you imagine what can happen? What would certainly happen if all these African heritage people ever realized their blood bonds, if they ever realize they all have a common goal, if they ever unite? The press was glad to get rid of me that day. I believe that the black brothers whom I had just recently left in Africa would have felt that I did the subject justice. Nearly through the night, my telephone at home kept ringing. My black brothers and sisters around New York and in some other cities were calling to congratulate me on what they had heard on the radio and television news broadcasts, and people, mostly white, were wanting to know if I would speak here or there. The next day, I was in my car driving along the freeway when at a red light another car pulled alongside. A white woman was driving, and on the passenger's side next to me was a white man. "Malcolm X," he called out, and when I looked, he stuck his hand out of his car, across at me, grinning. "Do you mind shaking hands with a white man?" Imagine that. Just as the traffic light turned green, I told him, "I don't mind shaking hands with human beings. Are you one?"